ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that on one's 250th birthday, there should be a celebration. I'm Claire Nichols, and on The Book Show, we're raising our teacups to Jane Austen.
Why Austen? What is it about her?
Authors Colm Tobin, Karen Joy Fowler, and more will explore why, in 2025, the Austen effect is bigger than ever.
It's quite incredible.
Search for The Book Show and look for Dear Jane wherever you get your podcasts, or hear it now on the ABC Listen app.
Artist Sarah Anderson was on a trip to Antarctica when she first encountered silence.
I paint, and one of the things I wanted to see was the turquoise and the blues of the icebergs. But one day, one particular day, we were put into these dinghies and we were going in and out of the icebergs. And then the guy turned the engine off. And it was completely silent. And then it began to snow. And I have never experienced such utter stillness and utter silence. It was magical.
Have you ever experienced silence like that? Powerful, beautiful quiet? You know, the philosopher Soren Kierkegaard said that if he could prescribe one thing for the world, he would prescribe silence. Perhaps that's what Sarah experienced in the dinghy that day, a kind of sacred hush there among the ice. My name's Meredith Lake, and Soul Search is a show curious about how we make and find meaning in life. In this episode, I'm taking a break from all the noise and the hustle and paying attention to silence. Why is it so precious in so many of the world's spiritual traditions? And where, or perhaps how, do we find it? Sarah Anderson has a fair few stories to share, because after that trip to Antarctica, she became very interested in silence. Her research took her to art galleries. It made her rethink music. It made her wonder why some of us are unsettled or even afraid of silence.
I've travelled quite a lot in my life, but Antarctica was absolutely top of my list. And so when I had the opportunity to go, I leapt at it. To be honest, I did not go to the Antarctic in search of silence. It happened once I was there.
Which is fascinating. I wonder if that's something that happens to many people, in fact, that silence is the kind of thing that comes upon you. Some people seek it, but other people find themselves in the midst of it. And yeah. I wonder what that was like for you. I mean, it can be unsettling, I'm sure.
Well, it can be. I'm not someone who's able to do long silent retreats, to be honest. I mean, I have done silent retreats, but they tend to freak me out. I mean, I find it fascinating that silence is so frightening. And I have several friends who, although they say they've enjoyed the book, but they say it's made them realize how much they absolutely hate silence. But when I was doing the research, there are various ways that I discover that are into silence that I hadn't really thought about before. For example, looking at paintings, I'd never really thought that some paintings are silent paintings and other paintings are noisy paintings.
What do you mean? What is a silent painting?
Well, a still life is a silent painting to me.
In what way?
By looking at it. First of all, I think you can have a real connection with the artist, and it can bring you back, or it bring you to a place of silence, whereas a painting by somebody like Bruegel is extremely noisy. You can just hear the noise coming out of it. I mean, of course, all paintings are silent, but Munch's The Scream, I think of as a profoundly silent painting. Other people might disagree. I mean, you can look at paintings, but to absorb the silence. And I mean, I quite often go to art galleries and draw paintings. And just sitting in front of a painting and drawing a still life is a profoundly silent moment for me.
You've talked about looking at a painting, but also the act of creation. And I wonder what it is that's generative about silence in your own practice as an artist, Sarah. Is that something you've always kind of been aware of, at least semi-consciously, or is this something that's come to the fore as your own artistic life and practices matured?
I think it's developed, definitely. To be honest, I sometimes or listen to music or a talk when I'm painting. I don't always paint in silence, which is maybe why I like painting outside so much, because then I am just listening. It's not silent necessarily, but, you know, it's bird sound or sounds of nature. But I think actually silence, well, I shouldn't be prescriptive, I suppose, but I think silence is necessary for creativity. I think it's very difficult to be totally creative if you've got somebody else's thoughts or sounds coming in at you.
It's fascinating to me that already in this conversation we've gravitated towards the language and the experience of the visual. I mean, silence is such a difficult thing in some ways to describe. I mean, this whole enterprise of having a conversation about it is replete with,
yes,
you know, all kinds of ironies.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And yet, you know, there's a tradition of discussing silence that goes back a very, very long way, as you very well know. But what is it when you talk about silence that you mean? I suspect it's more than, you know, the absence of sound.
Yeah, I was just going to say that. I think it is more than the absence of sound. I think it is something positive. Pythagoras actually said, learn to be silent. Let your quiet mind listen and absorb the silence. So by being silent, you are reinforcing the silence, I think, if that makes any sense at all.
Do you think silence has a place or a location?
Yeah. Stillness is an important component for me of silence. And I discovered as well silence in the desert in Botswana.
In Botswana?
In Botswana, and I can't possibly pronounce the name of the desert that I was in, but it's a big salt pan. And there was nothing there, and it was as flat and scrubby.
And yet what colour was it?
Whitish, very pale beige white. And we're encouraged to walk out into the distance at sundown. But it was an extraordinary feeling, except, of course, I knew that there were people behind me and around me. So it wasn't in any way scary. Because I think perhaps it can be rather frightening. These anechoic chambers where astronauts, for example, have to go before they go off into space, and they are completely silent rooms. There's no echo at all. And you can book yourself into one. And I think the recommended or the length of time is 45 minutes. But very, very few people can hack that. Most people freak out and have to leave after about 5 or 10 minutes. I do find that extraordinary. That total silence, people can't deal with it. And yet, is there ever total silence? Because you've always got your own body sounds. Your stomach is gurgling or whatever. And yet, apparently, even though astronauts have to go into these anechoic chambers, when they actually get into space, space is anything but silent, I gather. Mm. So it's quite elusive silence, I think.
How much is that elusiveness, do you think, a quality of modernity and particularly our very urbanized, very connected kind of societies? What do you think, in a sense, silence has always been something that needs to be actively pursued to be properly enjoyed?
Well, I think, I mean, what's interesting is that up until 100 years ago, or roughly 100 years ago, if you were on your own, there was no way of breaking the silence unless you talked to yourself. Now, at the press of a button, you can surround yourself with noise. So it's completely different from what it used to be. I think it was Aldous Huxley who said that the radio was the end of civilization or something.
No, we're complicit, I mean, you and I.
So exactly. It's as you well know, every religion through the ages has got silence at its core, something which people have always pursued. But it's just, I think it's more difficult now. I think now you have to make a conscious effort to be silent.
Has silence become rarer or harder to find amidst the cacophony of modern life? Sarah Anderson thinks yes, and she has a hunch that it matters. She's the author of The Lost Art of Silence. At the same time, silence is something people have always sought out. As Sarah said, it's valued in numerous traditions. And some people still seek it, actively and attentively, as something essential to their spiritual life.
I meet something there. Something appears. It's not just an emptying. It's also a filling up. It's a breathing out so that air can come in. It isn't an end in itself. Silence is a tool. It's a path.
Sheila Keane is a Quaker, part of the Society of Friends, which is a community renowned for meeting in silence. Silence is so important to her that she sits in silence for an hour every day. And I'm curious about how that came about.
I think it sort of snuck up on me, really. The thing where it became a conscious thing was actually when I came to Quakers when I was in my early 20s. I came into a Quaker meeting and sat down in the silence and felt instantly at home.
Really?
But silence was always sort of there for me. I used to love going to Allen's Cliffs, which was a little bit of farmland in our patch of suburbia, where you could go and, you know, listen to the birds and just be in the fields, and you know, that always attracted me, and I was always there, not talking to anybody or doing anything. So I suppose that's a draw into silence. But the intention, the conscious awareness of being in silence and exploring what silence has to give, came when I came to Quakers.
What was it that brought you to that first Quaker meeting? Why did you choose to go there that day?
Well, I was always drawn to sort of religious, spiritual experience as a child and as a teenager. It's involved in all kinds of church activities and stuff. In fact, felt very much like I was, you know, headed for a time in church. You know, at one point, doesn't everybody want to be a nun? quickly disabused of that. But then when I came out, that was sort of the end of it. And I spent a good 5 years sort of wandering around in the wilderness with no home. Mm. And discovered that Quakers was a place where you didn't have to fit in with anything in particular, except a desire to be in the spiritual truth of what you can reach in silence. And so it didn't matter. And I rocked up, and that's why I came that day. But it isn't why I stayed.
Yeah, the Quakers, I mean, they have Christian roots, going back to George Fox and the 17th mm-hmm. century. Mm-hmm. But did you see it as related to that Christian upbringing that you'd had, or did it feel like a departure for you at that point?
No, it didn't feel like a departure. It was sort of, it didn't matter. It was kind of irrelevant. To me, the Christian tradition has always been for me a metaphor, a mythic truth, rather than a creed to believe. And so when I came into the Quaker meeting and the Quaker faith, we really didn't talk much about whether it was Christian or not. I mean, people would reference Christian story and tradition, but also would reference other things. You know, Rumi is commonly referred to in Quaker circles. And, you know, he's a Sufi, not a Christian. So the theology becomes less and less relevant the closer you get to silence. And I think that's one of the reasons, actually, that silence engenders peace, because you leave away all of that intellectual identity that feels threatened when somebody disagrees with it.
I was reading in preparation for this conversation something Soren Kierkegaard said, that if he could prescribe one thing for the ills of the world, it would be silence. I wonder about that, because in some ways theology can be very exacting, but so can silence. It's not simple to practice. And I wonder what your experience of practicing silence has become over the many years, decades in fact, that you've been involved with the Quakers, because there's a rigor to it, a discipline certainly, that I'm very curious about.
Yeah, and it is something that sort of comes naturally. As I said, you know, when as a child, I went off to Allen's Cliffs. But it is also something that is learned, and there's a fairly well-known path. I mean, the monastic tradition has this down really pretty well.
Yes.
But my experience as a Quaker has been that my first foray into silence didn't need any introduction. The silence did it itself. It was an instant grab for me. It isn't true for everybody. Sometimes people go, oh, my God, this hour is going to just last forever. but, you know, a lot of people will follow this sort of, you know, following your breath or some of the meditation practices that, you know, allowing the thought to just pass through and things that you learn as techniques. But really, those are just things to strip aside what they call the monkey mind. And when that happens for me, the place I depart from Buddhist meditation is I meet something there. And
you meet something.
I meet something there. Something appears. It's not just an emptying. It's also a filling up. It's a breathing out so that air can come in. It isn't an end in itself. Silence is a tool. It's a path.
It's a path.
It's a framework. It's a verb.
Ah. Well, we were talking about it as something to be practiced. But what are its positive qualities? We are already not talking about the absence of sound or noise. What is silence, if I can ask it that bluntly?
Well, if you describe it as the effects of, silence is something that gathers. So when I sit down in a quiet place with other people who are entering into silence, the natural thing that happens is that we are gathered together in it. And there's a real sense of community. The Buddhist community calls that sangha. Mm-hmm. And it is just a reality that when we meditate together, when we come into silence together, we are drawn together. And so that's one of the things that is a positive element of silence. I think also for me, silence results in a sense of knowing, of seeing, and often it's seeing things that that are kind of like, oops, maybe I shouldn't have done that, or maybe I should be doing this. Sometimes the seeing is just remembering somebody who is having a hard time and just sort of sending out some love for them. Sometimes the seeing is, there was one time where I had been scheduled to go on a trip in 2 weeks' time, and I just suddenly knew that I had to go in 1 week's time. And so I did. And it turned out that there was a person who was there who wouldn't have been there in 2 weeks' time, who turned out to be a very key person in my life. So, you know, those kinds of things happen, and Quakers call them nudges or leadings. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a particularly unique, you know, it's particularly unique to Quakerism, this idea of being directly led by the experience, by the thing you meet in the silence.
The experience, the thing you meet. I'm so curious about this. I mean, it's so hard to speak about. And
it is.
You're right. The richness of the metaphors that we have for this kind of thing, you know, points to the difficulty, I think.
Yes.
But how do you know when you've met it or them or...
it is a very bad, that's not a very good word, but it's always been difficult to name this this thing that you meet. And the shorthand name is God, but God is such a poisoned word and it's so imprecise and it's so layered with other people's meanings that it's not a good word to convey because it isn't mutually understood. So Quakers often have, you know, over the years used all kinds of need, you know, the inward Christ, the light, the seed, the burning oneness binding everything. That's one of my one favorite ones.
What, the burning oneness
binding? The burning oneness binding everything. It's a Kenneth Boulding sonnet. The burning oneness binding everything. Mm. Yeah. So it's very hard to name, but there is a reality. I guess that's a good word. There's a reality that we meet when we come into a deep silence and we meet one another there. And that's what it is that brings us into a unity. It brings us closer to a reality that is one. And from that, it's like putting your foot on the ground, and from that you can spring forward. You can be moved forward because you have put your foot on the ground.
For Sheila, silence is grounding, a way of connecting with reality. It's become essential to her whole way of life. Sheila Kane is a member of the Society of Friends. The Quakers, as they're known, were famous for meeting in silence. As she said, though, silence is precious in many spiritual and religious traditions, from Buddhists to Benedictines, from Sufis to Taoists. On Soul Search, I'm curious about what it actually looks like for Sheila to practice silence as part of the pattern of ordinary life.
Well, the communal part is the most disciplined because if there's other people there, then I tend to show up, a bit like exercising. But that is every Sunday it's an hour of silence. And we sit in a circle and we enter into the silence together. And it's really quite amazing, actually, how I can bring my best attempt there, and I can get to a deeper place, much deeper with them than I can on my own. But if I don't do something to practice to get me sort of closer to the silence, then I'm starting from a very superficial place and I can't get very deep. So if I have some kind of preparation in between, you know, that helps me to go deeper and to meet people there and to put my foot on the ground so that I can then move forward. The discipline during the week, I try to have an hour every day, every afternoon at 2:00 actually is when it works for me. A lot of people do it in the morning, but I hate mornings. So 2:00 in the afternoon. And I will usually, I've got a particular place in my house, a little chair that I sit in, and I will sit quietly and... there's a discipline which I love, which is called gazing. I'm just gazing out the window, noticing the birds or feeling the wind, or it's not even that conscious. It's just gazing. That's a favorite practice of mine. There's centering prayer, just returning myself over and over and over again to the reality. Sometimes I journal. Often I journal three words and then stop writing. Sometimes I read. It might be a few paragraphs or something, but when it's just, those are just entry paths into the silence. And a lot of times when I sit there in the silence, absolutely nothing happens. Things irritate me. I think, did I forget to turn the stove off? You know, it isn't all roses and wonderfulness. It is, there's a discipline and it's not always perfect. And I don't always get there every afternoon. And, I guess it just has to be good enough.
You know, the making a habit of something like this is, I guess, what makes it so deeply formative. How long has this been your practice, Sheila? And how would you sketch what it has become of you to have embraced this in this way?
What an interesting question. I certainly feel very different. I feel a very different person now than I ever was in my 20s. I feel more quiet, more stable, more kind.
Kind? What's the connection, do you think, between silence and a kind of, I mean, it's common to connect silence with compassion or loving kindness, but what do you think that connection might be?
Well, as I said, I mean, one of the really common, well-known consequences of being in silence is to be gathered together. We're gathered in community. The Benedictines talk about it. The Buddhists talk about it. That is a function of silence. That is one of the things that silence is and does, is to bind us. And if we are bound together, that Quakers have this thing where they talk about there being that of God in others, you know, that of God in you and me and in the trees, and therefore, how could I possibly do anything unkind to you or the trees? The kindness proceeds from that sense of kinship that you find in the silence. And it's a deep, it's not a thought thing, it's not a belief thing, it's a in your bones experience thing. It's a bit like the difference between thinking that, you know, somebody should do something about that child who's being harassed to it's my child being harassed.
There's something compelling about it that you couldn't resist. It sounds almost like it's greater than your will, almost.
Yeah. I like to use this analogy. I have a little dog, a little Chihuahua rescue dog, and he is very dependent on my partner. They are, you know, joined at the hip, sometimes literally. And when she goes off to do errands or something, he will howl. He stands at the back deck and howls. And sometimes I can get his attention, but this one particular day, I had just had surgery, and I was I had my knee done, and so I was gimping around a bit. And she went out, and he howled, and I was just like, oh, the poor little fella. And I just got down and I cuddled him, and then I thought, how in the heck am I going to stand up? I didn't think about that I had a bad knee. I just thought, I must do this for this suffering beast, you know? It was an imperative, and it wasn't thought. It was simply the impulse and needed to occur, just like breathing needs to occur.
Can you imagine your life without a practice of silence? I mean, is it like breathing?
Well, I do yearn for it. And when I don't have it, I feel very hungry for more of it. I love going on silent retreats, the longer the better. Well, there is a limit to that. I like a
really?
Week.
Really? Okay. I have heard of people withdrawing for, you know, some years.
Yeah. I know some folks, some Quaker folks who do it for a couple of months, but no, that's a bit beyond me. But a day is not worth it. Yeah, it needs to be long enough to get somewhere. It's like getting an hour's sleep versus night.
So much of the way we, our contemporary society and culture operates is it's fast, it's loud, it's about extracting all kinds of things from us. Grind culture is kind of really pervasive, I think. In a way, it's hard to imagine anything other than a noisy, fast-paced, exhausted life. We all live them. And yet it sounds like you're saying that it's impossible to imagine a life without the silence and the slowness that comes with that, at least at some time of the day.
Yeah. It's possible to imagine it because I've lived it. But what has happened over time is that it has become increasingly intolerable to live it. And so I have sort of discarded bits along the way. So, like, I don't have a television, not because I have any objection to it, but it was just annoying.
Yeah.
And I only discovered that because I lived somewhere where I was doing work that I was too transient, and I discovered, oh, I like this quiet, you know?
Yeah.
So I didn't bother to get one when I came back. But all the busyness, that tends to drop away when I just feel harried by all of the pace. It's, you know, sometimes I feel like my head is inside a ringing bell. And so my world is very quiet. Like, I don't generally have the radio playing. I have things moving around me slowly. I used to work as a physiotherapist in a rehab hospital, and I just could not tolerate it because the pace was so fast, and I just wanted to be with people and listen to their stories and accompany them on this miraculous journey of what it is to heal. And what I ended up doing was going into private practice so that I could spend whatever time I wanted to with them, and I didn't have to worry about whether I was meeting my productivity quotient. And there's a greater financial insecurity in that, but those have been my decisions all along, is to leave things that were more stable and more secure and more worldly valued, going towards things that just brought me closer to that allowed me to stay close and brought me closer to this inward reality that is silence. And I guess that's what that's what early friends talked about, is this idea of being converted. You have this desire for something, and that desire actually changes how you live your life. So it's a conversion by desire. The Quakers don't actually have a set of beliefs that you have to believe. Mm-hmm. What they have as a guide is a thing called advices and queries. So our creeds are mostly set out in questions. Like, do you set aside enough time to be in silence is one of the questions. And a few advices. The first one is my favorite. Take heed, dear friends, to the promptings of love and truth in your heart. Trust them as the leadings of God, which show us our darkness and lead us into new light.
I mean, you've accompanied a lot of people. You lead retreats. You've been part of Quaker communities for a really long time. What's the most common breakthrough that people have in order to make silence such a generative part of who they are and how they move in the world?
Well, as a person who's, as a facilitator and watching people come into that depth, the thing that that always happens is I usually construct my courses in over a 5-day span, and I spend the first couple of days kind of getting people into a little bit deeper space, and then the third day we spend in silence, and that's when the magic happens. It has nothing to do with me. It's an interior encounter that no one can do for you. You can be guided and accompanied, but in the end, it really just takes willingness and grace. You know, it's something that's given. And I often, there's this little game, this little children's game where it was a fishing rod with a magnet.
Oh, yeah.
And these fish. And I always just sort of have this feeling that if you wave the fishing rod just in the general vicinity, you're bound to catch a fish, you know. So that's what I try to do, is to bring people near the magnet and let the magnet do the work.
Because there's an abundance there.
Yes.
Yeah.
Sheila Keane joined the Quakers back in the early 1980s, and over the years she's accompanied many people on the path of silence. These days she's retired from her profession of physiotherapy, but she's still very involved with the Silver Wattle Retreat Centre near Canberra, which hosts all kinds of people who share a commitment to spiritual development and to nonviolent witness. I'm Meredith Lake, with you for Soul Search, the show exploring spirituality in contemporary life. And I want to go back to Sarah Anderson now, who experienced an almost magical silence on the dinghy that day among the icebergs. Her relationship to silence is more exploratory than practiced, but she thinks silence is worth seeking out. Sarah is a painter, the proprietor of the Notting Hill Travel Bookshop in London, and the author of The Lost Art of Silence, Reconnecting to the Power and Beauty of Quiet.
You said earlier, Sarah, that you have travelled very widely, and not only that, you've mixed with many travel writers and travellers, not least as the proprietor of the Notting Hill Travel Bookshop. I wonder what you think travel has to do with the pursuit of silence. Do you think there's been an uptick in people seeking out silence by, you know, leaving a city like London, venturing into other places? Or do you think perhaps the bookshop in itself is a refuge for those seeking silence?
Well, I don't think that most people travel in search of silence. I think that possibly it's a benefit which they hadn't expected. Yes, I mean, I mentioned quite a lot of travel writers, but most of them I don't think went off in pursuit of silence. I think it was a bonus if they came across it. It is difficult to write about silence because silence doesn't have any words. So it's a kind of, as you say, here we are doing a radio program talking about something which is wordless.
I mean, it's not a challenge unique to, you know, broadcasting. I mean, there are whole traditions of theology and other spiritual traditions that have grappled with the how do you speak of the unspeakable, whether that might be what you might term God or silence. Do you see a connection between silence and divinity? I mean, was that part of the way you encountered religion growing up? I mean, you said earlier that all religions have silence at their core, but how did you learn that? Was it something you were taught or that you've come to?
It's something that I've come to. I was brought up a Catholic. In fact, I'm still Catholic. But the Catholic Church, I think, has become a noisy church. I went to a Quaker meeting when I was doing my research. I'd never been to one before. And I found that I loved it, actually. It wasn't a false silence. It seemed to me a completely natural silence. You just sat there. And it was, as I say, a really special, natural feeling. And I remember going quite soon after that to a funeral in a Catholic church. And as you probably know, if you go into any church when there's going to be an event like a funeral or something, the noise, everyone, you know, people haven't seen each other for a long time or something, and it's quite extraordinary, the amount of noise. So I was thinking, gosh, what a contrast. I think the church now thinks that people are scared of silence. Maybe they are. So they don't incorporate it into their services, which I think is a huge pity. So, yes, I discovered it. I have been off on silent retreats, not long silent retreats, but certainly silent retreats. And I do try and meditate every day. I find it difficult. I'm not a naturally silent person, but as I say, I think, you know, my book was written for me, really.
Sarah, I know from reading your book that you grew up with a very particular silence in your home relating to your own experience, even to your own body. But I wonder if you could just describe what that silence was about and the effect of it on you as a young person.
Okay, yes. Well, when I was 10 years old, I had cancer, a synovial sarcoma on my left elbow. So I had my left arm amputated at the age of 10. Well, as far as my family were concerned, they made it seem that there was no difference. I was treated exactly the same as I had been, which was great. And I then went off to boarding school, and I was at boarding school for 5 years, and no one during that whole 5 years ever referred to the fact that I had one arm. And for me, that silence was brilliant. I loved it, because if no one talked about it, then it didn't exist.
Well, why was that liberating?
I felt it was, well, I didn't think about it in those terms until afterwards. But it was because if it wasn't talked about, then it hadn't happened. So in that sense, silence, it was my friend. If it had happened today, you know, however many years later, 60 years later, nearly 70 years later, it would have been completely different. I think I would have had, you know, social workers and people encouraging me to talk about it. And actually, I was terribly happy with that silence. But on the other hand, I'm going to contradict myself in a way, because I went to America when I was in my early 20s. And there it seemed natural for people to ask what had happened. So they'd say to me, hey, what's happened to your arm? And it, in a way, it was such a relief to be able to tell them. So I am contradicting myself. But well, as a child, I was happy.
It's not necessarily a contradiction. I mean, it perhaps points to the way silence carries more than one meaning. It surely
definitely
must.
Yes, indeed. And there is a dark side to silence, of course. People in solitary confinement, for example, and censorship, which is a form of silencing. And I think you have to include all of that as well.
This correlation between silencing and the exercise of power perhaps is a... I don't know. How do you distinguish between what you might call oppressive silence and positive silence?
Well, surely I think negative silence is imposed silence, isn't it? Imposed by somebody else. Solitary confinement or censorship and all those things, whereas the silence that the beneficial silence is chosen or accepted, I think. Yeah.
Why do you think we crave silence, even when it is unsettling, when it's difficult, when we live in noisy environments? What is it that we miss if there is no true silence?
I think we miss connection to the eternal, or however you'd like to term to God, or I think that bond, that link is much stronger, that silent link is much stronger. I think with somebody described it once as being like a swimming pool, all the children are chattering in the shallow end, whereas in the deep end, you have this much more silent aloneness.
Throughout human history. There have been movements of people actively and at sometimes considerable cost seeking a kind of silence.
Yeah.
And I was fascinated to read in your book that in English, the first appearance of the word silence was in a text written for 12th century women seeking a devoted life of an anchoress, of withdrawal, of enclosure, of devotion, and that the pursuit of the divine or of the holy has certainly been very energizing for people who've sought silence in that kind of very radical way.
Yeah, I mean, I think silence is at the heart of most, if not all, religions, although you wouldn't sometimes know it. But I mean, it's, as you know, in the 1960s, a whole lot of Westerners went off to India because they thought they'd discovered meditation for the first time. But actually, of course, meditation was part of the Christian church in the 3rd century AD. So that was rediscovered. And John Mayne was certainly somebody who brought that back to the West.
And the recovery of those elements, the pursuit of silence, like the pursuit of solitude, seems to be having a kind of moment.
Revival.
Yes. Yeah. And I wonder what that reveals about the nature of our yearnings, in fact.
Yeah, well, I think you're right. But I think one of the reasons is that we live in a noisier world now than we have ever lived in before. Walking down the street is, well, you live in the desert, so maybe you're not as...
There are people here too.
Yeah.
I'm not a hermit.
But nevertheless, I mean, in a city, it's constant noise. So I think a withdrawal from that, you know, it's almost perhaps a sort of tipping point. And there are places, even in a city, where you can go and be quiet. I mean, churches actually are now most often certainly open or can be, and you can just go in and be silent, or parks, or cemeteries even are quite good places for quiet spots. So they do exist, these quiet spots. But to go back to something you said earlier about why it was important, and I think a rather telling story or event was the guy called Christopher Knight, who was known as the North Pond Hermit, who lived in the woods of Maine for 27 years without being discovered, which is quite extraordinary because he was actually quite close to other people. And one of the things, he stole food from other people's houses just enough to survive, but he also stole books and he would always return them once he'd read them. And apparently he remembered everything that he read because he was reading, of course, in complete silence. Whereas, you know, when I read, when we read nowadays, there's noise around. Well, I find that, you know, there's either somebody coming in or phone rings or something, or I get distracted.
Yeah. What do you think silence or the habit of silence means for our relationships with each other? Because it can be communal in a way.
Yeah. Well, I think you're absolutely, I mean, yes, I think that if you truly want to listen to another person, you have to do it in silence. And I think that if you are aware of that, there are very few people in my experience who are really, really good listeners. And once you come across them, I mean, it's so wonderful to talk to somebody, that's maybe again paradoxical, who is a good listener. And it's a wonderful thing. By being silent yourself, you are actually benefiting other people, I think. And the other thing I'd quite like to just to bring up, because we haven't touched on it yet, is silence in music. Again, which seems paradoxical, but I spoke to several musicians and they said that it was the pauses in between the music which were incredibly important, which is...
You know, Sarah, when my first child was born, one of my siblings composed a piece of music on the piano. It is so spacious. And it's the space between the notes and the sparseness of the music that immediately created a stillness and a quiet and a kind of life that in the frantic world of newborn children and recovering from birth and all those things was an incredibly precious gift. I mean, it's one of the most precious things I've ever been given by anybody.
Yeah.
Piece of music. I mean, he was a very young man when he composed it, but he told me later that it was an improvised piece, but to prepare to record it, he meditated for days and stilled himself in order to offer something as spacious and as quiet a piece of music as that.
Yeah, yes. Arthur Schnabel, the Austrian pianist, wrote about his music, "The notes I handle no better than many pianists, but the pauses between the notes are, that is where the art resides."
I was struck reading your book on the lost art of silence. I mean, even to think about silence as an art is fascinating to me, Sarah. But you quote the philosopher Soren Kierkegaard, if he could prescribe one thing for the world, it would be silence.
Yes, and
I will keep thinking about that. You quote him with approval. Do you agree and why?
Yes, well, I think perhaps I don't think we think about it enough. I don't think it is thought about enough, maybe I should say, put it that way. People who are encouraged to be silent, who don't fight against it, I think realize the benefits. So I think that he's right to say that it would be a good prescription for the world to be more silent and to listen. That's the other thing, of course. You know, if you can't really listen, I mean, okay, we were talked about it in relation to other people, listening to people if you are silent, but also if you're going for a walk, for example, and just listening to the sounds of nature, and that sounds quite corny, but it's incredibly important, I think. And this link that we have, if you meet somebody who you have no language in common with, you can. There are ways of communicating, silent ways of communicating, I think, which are quite deep and powerful, and those perhaps should be developed.
Sarah Anderson is the author of The Lost Art of Silence and the proprietor of London's Notting Hill Travel Bookshop. She's been sharing a few stories from her own adventures and travels, which helped to focus her interest in silence. Before Sarah, you heard from Quaker Sheila Kane all about how and why she practices silence. And if you've enjoyed listening to these conversations, why not share them with a friend? Post a link to Soul Search on your social media or mention it over coffee. If you're listening to the podcast with the ABC Listen app, you can just tap the dots for a share episode option. I'm Meredith Lake, and that's all on Soul Search right now, but I hope you can join me again for more curious conversations about contemporary spirituality. You can find us on your radio with RN and Radio Australia, and by podcast with ABC Listen. Thank you.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.